this is one of the greatest tragedies of the gaming space, is that Transistor came out and solved all the problems BioWare was trying to solve for years. And they just did it one time as this kind of experiment, and no one has tried to do anything with it again since.
This is why you should play Transistor. Why, hello, and welcome to another episode of Why You Should Play. We've obviously had a pretty late start to the year in terms of recording and producing and releasing episodes, so I've been wanting to play a little bit of catch-up, which is appropriate because, as I'm sure many of you do as well, the backlog is not getting any lighter. I remember when 2024 was supposed to be a lighter year as compared to 2023, and sure enough, I've been playing almost nothing but new releases, but in the meantime, I try to sneak in a game or two, including games for this podcast, and one that I've been wanting to get to for some time that, believe it or not, many of you will be shocked to hear this. I started it many, many years ago, but actually dropped it.
I'm so shocked.
I know, you're shocked. You and many others are just... I'll give everyone a moment to process that, so... Okay. I dropped it because I had no idea what the combat was going to be going in, and I was very taken aback and... almost like a child who encounters a specific vegetable for the first time. They're like horrified and disgusted and turned off, and they just shove the plate away and pout. So that was kind of me with Transistor, but I have learned my ways, and in the immortal words of Danny DeVito, I get it now. So my guest today is, I'm fortunate enough to have found maybe the biggest Transistor fan on the planet. Maybe there's one or two others that would contest that, but you know, I don't really care. It's my show, and I pick who comes on. And I forget his exact story with Transistor, which he will talk about, as I do with every guest. But the guest I have here today is a self-published author of a book called Metanoia. That's M as in Mary, Etanoia. Please go buy a book. He is a hopefully sooner rather than later to be self-published game developer of a game called Defensive Nations. Go play demo on Steam. Go add to wishlist on Steam right now. It's a very fine mix of, I would call it like a kind of a bureaucratic management sim mixed with a tower defense, both of which I'm in the mood for from time to time, especially tower defense. So very encouraging demo, a horrifying monster at the end, which was surprisingly tough, which I complained to him about. I'm sure he's put it in the developer notes already and worked out a patch and a fix. So,
Developer notes?
I don't know. What do you call it? Patch notes? User feedback? Send it to the...
I take user feedback. That's news to me.
You do? I don't know. I can... You're your own community manager too. So you get the brunt of everything. So
there's one rule: ignore them.
Good. Yeah. Don't compromise your creative vision. That's what I always say with my podcast.
Never. I never have bad ideas.
Never. No. You're like Kojima in that regard. And last but not least, as I cited on his previous appearance, and I will continue to cite for every time that he appears on here, he is a fellow Chad lover of the epic weapon known as the trebuchet. He is Connor. Connor, how are you doing today?
I am doing all right. I am alive. That's pretty good.
Yeah, this is maybe not necessarily a positive, but I forgot to mention that you are recently returned to the traditional oppressive working man 9-to-5 Monday to Friday. So when you say you're fine, I get that, and I totally understand. You know, it's we take what we can get.
It's great to have income again, but boy, I hate getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I just hate it.
I hear that, especially the couple times a year when the time changes and it's like your body has to readjust again. But I try not to complain too much about tiredness because I'm blessed to be able to work from home full time Monday to Friday. So I don't complain, and I joke as well that not only do I work from home entirely, I don't have a significant other or kids, so it's pretty much just me. So I have relatively little outside concerns in my immediate day-to-day. So I'm pretty lucky in that regard. But as is tradition with this podcast, and I've broached with other guests, and I will broach with you as well, is you have your own furry friend, Cat Child, a beautiful orange cat that seems to be a stage 5 clinger for you, like always, just like draped over you like a shawl of some sort. But is it a he or she named Moss?
He.
His name is Moss.
Moss.
Moss. Yeah, he's a beautiful cat. How is Moss?
Like a Norwegian forest cat or something like that.
Yeah, just a beautiful. How is Moss this fine day? How's he been?
He's doing fantastic, as he always is. He is a big doofus, and he's technically my cousin's cat, and he's big dumb idiot, but he is so loving and so playful. And it's great. He will absolutely accidentally hurt you though if you're not careful.
Oh yeah, those cats' claws are no jokes. Their bites honestly are kind of a joke. They're kind of like a little nip, but yeah, their claws are.
Oh yeah.
Even if it's accidental, man, even if those claws accidentally retract and dig in a little bit, you feel them. So.
And he's a little bit stupid, so
that's okay.
He will sometimes just get those claws in places they should not be. And he doesn't mean anything, but he's adorable enough, I don't even care.
Yeah, that is the most boy behavior to be stupid and get yourself in somewhat compromising situations. So
yeah.
Very, very on brand for a boy. Awesome. Yeah, and I guess you're a fellow 9-to-5 Monday to Friday individual, so I greatly appreciate you taking time out of your weekend. I'm glad we were able to. Is that a dog? Are they jealous that I didn't ask about the dog?
Yes, that's the young Weimaraner pup that's around here.
Oh, okay,
he gets very excited sometimes for no good reason.
Well, we can go with he's excited about recording the podcast, so that's good. Yeah, so it's good.
Yeah,
that
sounds about right.
It's good to hear that he's doing well and lively as well. So
yeah, that's why he's placing himself right underneath my room before he barks.
Oh, of course. Yeah, very strategic to be heard. So that's yep. Good. So yeah, I appreciate you taking time out of your weekend. I'm glad we were able to schedule this pretty short notice.
No worries.
We've been keeping in touch. You know, I joke with people that when I bring them on the podcast, I say, when I start DMing them about scheduling, I said, oh, by the way, I'm going to use this DM as kind of like a stream of consciousness for my playthrough and my commentary. So it serves multiple purposes, and it's good to be able to schedule things on short notice. So another tradition with this podcast, kind of a soft opening to talk about games, is what are you currently playing, and you know, what have you recently played or want to shout out?
Well, I've been trying to play Dragon's Dogma 2, but I have been getting so distracted from games recently. Actually, I've ended up spending more time the last few weeks writing more than anything.
That's good. I'm sure you can sympathize with this as well. But a lot of times when I'm done with work for the day, again, even though I'm like work from home and I'm kind of in the same immediate space, I don't necessarily really want to hunker down and focus on something new. I don't want to
productive. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it's just something as enjoyable of a game, and I'm loving Dragon's Dogma, but I can't immediately pivot to something. Like I literally need to go outside and take a walk. Sometimes, you know, I get off, I log off at 5 p.m. and all of a sudden it's like 7:30 and I'm like, oh, do I really want to start a game session this late? So yeah, I totally get it. And writing is, I would guess that it's a little bit more zen and peaceful and a little bit more chill of a vibe when you're doing that.
Yeah, when you've put 2,500 hours or so into a story, you kind of get to a point where you can do it automatically and not have to think so hard. I mean, there's a lot of thinking getting done, but it's just like picking up old threads that I've been working on for a long time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I can understand that. And in fact, I need to get back to a script for a YouTube video that I want to do. It's kind of like a little mini series that I'm going to do as like a side spinoff to this podcast. And I just, the hardest part for me when working on anything, whether it's this or a task at my job or this script that I want to work on, is just starting it. It's kind of like just initially getting that ball rolling. And I find that the hardest is for when I'm working on something is to start it and then to end it. Like especially a creative venture, like when is the perfect endpoint, you know, for the story or for this podcast episode or whatever I'm working on. So
yeah, it's like for creative ventures, your brain gets two modes that can switch between the hard to start or the easy to start and never finish.
Yeah, for sure. Being in the corporate environment, having deadlines is oftentimes a good thing. Cause it's like, hey, this is when this is needed by someone else. So that dictates when you need to get it done and prioritize from there. So
Lord knows I program in an entirely different way when I'm on my job than versus working on my own things. It's like, oh, what's the quickest way we can get this done? All right, now let's take that and make it slightly more resilient. And I'm just going to go with that because I can get it done today.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's an old saying, I forget the exact saying, but it's like deadlines breed creativity or ingenuity. It's like, well, we got to get this done. How are we going to kind of pull up MacGyver and then patchwork these multiple entities or aspects together to make something that's cohesive? But it's good. Dragon's Dogma 2 is
it's exactly what I've been hoping for 10 years.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. And it seems like it seems to be a good synergy between, it sounds like it's the game that Hideaki Itsuno always wanted to make, and it's the game that you and many other longtime Dragon's Dogma fans wanted to play. And I'm picking up on things much better than I anticipated I was going to, because I heard about how relatively inaccessible it was between like the limited fast travel and some obtuse quest lines and everything. But it's like, no, I'm picking up on things. In fact, there was one quest that I kind of completed by stumbling into. It was a rare case of where being a dumb boy or guy paid off. There was an NPC in the middle of a quest who gave me a really cryptic message, like, you need to recreate and do what I'm doing. And I'm like, well, she followed me. I guess I need to follow someone or something. And then I saw an NPC run away behind a door. And I'm like, oh, what am I supposed to do? Go to the store. And then I looked off to the side and I'm like, ooh, a ladder. And, you know, in Dragon's Dogma, like, it's a meme at this point. Like, ladders are always called out by NPCs. And I'm like, oh, I'm just going to go down this ladder because, I don't know, it's a ladder. Like, you know, between, like, Dark Souls games and...
If it exists, you should probably climb it.
Yes. And sure enough, that ladder was exactly where the quest was leading to. I'm like, oh, that's good. So I feel smart in a video game. So
it's such a funny game.
It really is. And that ladder...
how the pawns actually point out a bunch of useful stuff or actually provide useful context. I had one of the... one of the Discord community members, pawns in my party, and I walked by this rock and I just incidentally ended up stopping for a bit. And I have the game entirely in Japanese, so I can't understand anything anyone's saying. But then I just see this pawn start attacking a rock. Just no idea why. They're just shooting magic blasts at a rock. I'm like, okay, dude, AI is doing something weird, huh? And then a few seconds later, the rock shatters and there's a path behind it. I'm like, oh.
What? Huh.
I guess our community member found that path on his playthrough and the pawn remembered the location. This is why I love this game.
That's crazy. That is like something you would almost see in a Souls game. And here it's like you hear about someone having to hit a section of a wall like 99 times. And I'm just like, who? It's like, do the devs really need that much time to make a game? Like, how much time did someone...
I mean... If I had gone hit the rock, I would have been able to tell because it would have reacted. It's just, it looks so much like the rest of the environment.
That's crazy. Yeah, that pawn system really is amazing. It really is a sort of a contextual, customized experience of a guide. Like you would look up online. So, but it feels more dynamic, and it's obviously a mechanic within the world, and it's great, and it kind of bridges that gap between. Really isolated single player and full-blown co-op. I was talking to someone else, like, I would really like even limited aspects of full co-op would be cool, even if it's just two player, but the pawn system is so cool that I don't mind it not being there too much.
I actually really enjoy just like finding a group of pawns, seeing what sort of logic they have, and then making my fight style kind of work with whatever they're doing.
Yeah, for sure. It really is like almost fitting puzzle pieces together. Like I had one party construction that was, I was a mage. There was another mage. And of course, like spells were just going off everywhere. It was just chaos. And then I had an archer and I had a fighter, I think it was. Not the big, heavy, like hammer axe fighter, the sword and board. Yeah, the sword and board one. So the game is a lot of fun. I'm only like 20 hours in, but I'm so excited to play more. I do not understand how people reviewed this game after only like 10 hours or even 20 hours. Like I get there's very limited time between when they get review codes and when the embargo is, but the discourse as usual has been just nonsensical and toxic. And
oh yeah, it was the same when the first game came out.
Yeah. All the better reason for, if you're looking forward to a game and you want to get it day one and reviews are generally good, just
get it. Does it look pretty? Go get it.
Yeah, just go buy it and play it and enjoy it. And that's certainly what I've been doing. I don't think I've even really looked at or watched a single review from beginning to end. I mean, the performance issues are what they are, but they're already starting to address that with a single patch, and I'm sure there'll be more to come. And
they only re-released the first game about 15 times, so there will be a better version eventually. If it's so egregious to you that you can't get over it, then just wait a couple of years. I'm happy now.
Yeah, I'm happy too. I've tweaked a little bit of settings on PC just to get a higher, more stable frame rate. Like I want to try to get for 60 on PC because I have a pretty high rig, and so in fact, I think I consulted with you on some tweaking some settings about like
probably
textures and I think shadows or something else, and that really helped a lot. So yeah, I mean, I'm getting roughly 60, 55, 60 in the open world during combat, which again, with the spells that are flying off everywhere and the physics and the NPCs that can appear, I'm happy. But I have yet to fire it up and play it since this recent patch. So it'll be even better. It should be. So I'm excited to play more of it for sure. I think you mentioned programming and development, and the game that we're going to discuss today certainly invokes kind of
yes, it does
the vernacular. I was very kind of tickled to see that because I've dabbled a little bit into programming many, many years ago, not as much anymore. Not really heavy software development programming, but some coding. And this game called Transistor was developed by Supergiant Games, who we are big fans of on this podcast. We previously did Transistor, I believe, was not Transistor. We did Bastion, their first game, was yep. with the fine young man Cole, who goes by Compulsive Nerd. Just a really, really fine, lovely debut outing from a studio. And there's a lot of DNA in that game, unsurprisingly, in Transistor. But it released on PlayStation and PC on May 20th, 2014. So it is becoming 10 years old here pretty soon, just under a couple of months. Time just absolutely flies. None of us are getting any younger. And then it did also release on Switch on November 1st, 2018. It's unfortunately still not on Xbox. So we kind of have back-to-back episodes of kind of odd, still exclusivity situations for games that are a decade or older. Discussing KOTOR 1 and 2 with Maddie, that's still not on PlayStation, and this game is still not on Xbox. But no, I played it on Steam on PC. I don't think you can... I even looked online. It's a maximum of 60 FPS, so I don't know that there really is any advantages to playing it on any of the platforms. So I think it just comes down to personal preference.
No, not really. And at this point, any laptop that out there can play the game at perfectly reasonable 60 frames per second, probably even. So it might not be on Xbox, but if you have an electronic device, you can probably play the game just fine.
Yeah, in fact, I think it is on I think it is on mobile stores as well, iOS or an Android. I think it still is. I don't have the rest of the release info, but yeah, I'm almost positive it is. But yeah, it's on pretty much every platform except for Xbox, unfortunately. And like you said, it doesn't take much power. It's a 10-year-old game. It's an indie game for that time. But let's dive into this game called Transistor. And I'll start with the setup and kind of the premise. I know I have in the agenda, the first thing I wanted to cover is the world and art, but kind of want to do a little bit of table setting. It is an isometric game. You play as a character named Red. She is I believe she's in her mid-20s, and she has, wait for it, red hair. And I love her outfit. It's kind of hard. I don't know how I would describe it. It's almost like a V-neck blouse almost.
Yeah, it's kind of like a 20s flapper isn't the word I was looking for, but that kind of Art Nouveau.
Yes.
Right before the Great Depression, when everyone was really excited, the Great Gatsby.
Roaring 20s.
Yeah, Roaring 20s. Yeah. It's got that. It's got some Art Nouveau, as I mentioned. It's very striking.
Yeah, she is a singer. And like when you look at her and you see her, like she is dressed like someone who would appear on stage as a singer. Like she would be singing in a small kind of smoky, smoke-filled club.
Cocktail lounge.
Yes, exactly. Cocktail lounge. Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, she totally is that. Again, it's Supergiant, and we'll go into this in shortly. It's the look of her is very distinct. Like when you see artwork of her, like you know exactly who that is. It's not just a standard young redhead woman. And the world I would describe as it's just after an apocalyptic event. I wouldn't quite describe it as truly post-apocalyptic.
It's in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's kind of in the middle of it. It's like stuff just went down. There's bodies, occasional body lying around the city that you're in. And the city's name is Cloudbank. Literally the name of a very corporate type of bank. And in the true supergiant fashion, the city itself is very visually striking.
Oh, yes.
And colorful. Lots of lights, but it's not gaudy or tacky looking. Everything feels like it fits and exists together and is cohesive. So it starts out with her waking up and she sees a man who has been killed. And next to her is, believe it or not, is a giant glowing greatsword. Think of like the Buster Sword from Final Fantasy VII. The big sword is really a mainstay in many a video game. It really is almost like its own character.
Big Sword is the best character in almost any story in which it's featured.
It certainly is in this game as well. And the sword itself is shaped like a piece of electronics, almost like a computer chip.
It is the titular transistor.
Yes, it is. That is correct. Yeah. I wasn't sure whether it was or not. I couldn't remember of a picture of a transistor, but yeah, it's such a cool mix of gameplay and themes and narrative. And so I did a very nerdy thing. I looked up the definition of a transistor, and the quick definition that I found is it is a semiconductor device with three connections capable of amplification in addition to recidification. So we'll go into the combat a little bit more, but you get this big sword, which again, it's very iconic artwork. She's a mid-20s female artist. She's not necessarily buff, so she kind of drags the sword around along the ground and little sparks kick up. It's great animation. And play this game with a controller. I think that's recommended. Yep. I think it's, in fact, it's like strongly recommended.
That's how I've always played it.
Yeah, that's how I've always played it. And I used an Xbox controller, and you need to hit the R1 button because it does this sword toss, and she does this sort of little pirouette into the air and grabs it. So it's great. It's a little touch like that. It just gives her personality, even though part of the story is that of everything that was taken away from this beautiful, vibrant city, part of that was her voice was taken away as well. So it's like kind of her primary means and her most memorable means of expression was her singing voice. So
it's her talent.
Yeah, it is her talent. It's what she contributes to society. And that's part of it that we'll talk about as well with some of the characters. But the first thing that I wanted to talk about with the game is the world and the art. And with any Supergiant game, certainly with Bastion and Transistor and Hades, I still have yet to play Pyre. But when I looked at some screenshots of Pyre, I'm like, yeah, that's a Supergiant game, down from the character arts to the way the world, the environments are drawn. It's very much Supergiant. And so what I do like about it is that it is, like I said, it's somewhere between the actual current apocalyptic event going on and a little time before post-apocalyptic. It's like things have just happened. The city is very quiet and desolate. There are a lot of noir vibes. So what I mean by that is very much red, kind of against this whole city that is pretty much more or less hostile to her.
It's a quiet story that's focused on a very small cast of characters, of central characters.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned this to you as well, and I'll shut up and kind of let you take it from here, is that I like that it does have noir vibes down to, I forgot to mention this, the man that was killed, his spirit, soul, whatever, his essence is trapped inside the sword. So it talks to you. So you're dragging around this big, I guess we can call it an sword if you want to, I guess. Very.
No, I don't want to.
You don't want to. Go. Good.
That's one thing I love about this game.
Okay. It's good. Good.
It's so distinct in its art style. It's okay. Like, it really captures that kind of those historical, very American in a way, or like at least European as well, but just that kind of art, and it brings it to games. It's just something that's like Batman the Animated Series and how visually striking that is. Yeah. And just, you rarely see stuff like that.
Yeah, I was thinking Art Deco as well, but it's a good blend of that and futurism as well. There's these modern looking panels and kiosks that you go to. It all just interweaves and meshes so well together.
You could probably say it does blend in some elements of, but it's kind of just the parts where artists have the way they do certain things. It's just kind of shifted over time. It's not like the essence of the Japanese animated style has the essence of like the Western, or like historical Western styles. It just has modern techniques is how I would put it.
For sure. Well, I think what I'll do is I'll probably bleep out the word and I'll just edit out.
That's fine.
Okay. To go back to my original point with this, what struck me immediately was that sort of post-apocalyptic event, but not in like a really super dour, brutalist architecture, desaturated colors. It's this contrast of like this horrible event that happened was then, you know, moments ago, flourishing city that just looked like an absolute, almost like an oasis.
Dream. Literally like dream.
Yeah, it is very...
City in the clouds, basically.
Yeah, it is very surrealist. There's some good striking visuals as well and some like kind of interstitial moments between when you travel between areas. So yeah, talk a little bit more about kind of the world and the artwork, if you will, and the environments.
Yeah, I do have to be a little careful about spoiling things because what I love so much about the world is how all these themes fit together with everything that's happening in it and how all the backstory of it. Like you said, it's called Cloud Bank, and it's this city that's essentially in, like you mentioned, where there's all these programming terms. Well, that's the very basis of the city is basically one town run on software. It shifts according to what people want. It's like the ultimate of what everyone's dreaming of they can always have a say in what's happening. And just having a say is enough to make reality, where you go to these terminals and you get to do things like vote on what the weather is going to be today. And then something happens and boom, we have a nice glowing orange sunset for tonight. Right? The city's constantly shifting and everything's constantly changing. And it's so gorgeous and beautiful and idealistic in a lot of ways, but there's also something kind of scary about it, which is when it gets to what's going on in the story. And I like the fact that the transistor is kind of the key to this whole thing that's happening, because that's, now I'm not an electrical engineer, so I might be a little bit wrong, but as a programmer, I feel like I should kind of do know what I'm talking about. I'm pretty sure that's about as confident as any programmer ever is. But the transistor kind of is the key to making software work. It is a piece of electrical hardware that can change its state without having to change its physical state. You'll send electrical signal to one part of it, and then that changes whether or not a gate's open, if I'm remembering correctly. The transistors are those millions of little things that are in your CPU that make it do the thinking, make that change possible.
Yeah, that's a good way of explaining it. And it's honestly, it makes me appreciate the game even more thematically, which I think you did a really good job of speaking to it without really coming close to spoiling it. But kind of with when we brought up the premise of the game and how the society works, you can maybe sort of guess where things went wrong. But it does it in a way that I found really surprising. We'll go into more of that with the characters. And I don't know, maybe my takeaway from it will be different from yours and we'll have better discussion. But another thing, the way how beautiful the city is makes it even more of a tragedy.
Yes.
Of what happened to it. And you're like, everything, every time you, wherever you go through the city, you're like, God, all I could think of was like, man, what a shame. Go to all these places and you read logs and like news reports and stuff.
That's a really good way of putting it. Cause it's not like that era, the like 2007 to 2000, honestly, Last of Us came out in 2013, so I don't even think the era really ended until like 2015, 2016. What did Days Gone come by? Is that the end of the apocalypse trend?
I'm not sure, but I just played the demo for the game Stellar Blade, and I'm like, oh, it kind of looks like the game looks fun to play, and there's some cool like creature design and stuff, but like the city and stuff, it looks like a generic sort of like post-apocalyptic city. Like there's overgrowth and there's collapsed buildings, and but yet all the fences are like working and locked. I'm like, okay.
Then I'm remembering Nier Automata came out in like 2017, so really the apocalypse trend has never really ended, but especially in that like Xbox 360 and starting of the next gen PS4 gen, that era, there were so many gray brown apocalypses, and part of that was the technology at the time, but it was so refreshing to see this bright colorful game that even though it was doing the same thing, it did not feel the same at all. This was like this personal, things like you said, noir story. And it's this big event in the background, but you are only observing it from this really personal, intimate perspective. And it's so vibrant and it is such a shame. That's what it makes you feel more than anything.
Yeah. And it's funny you've mentioned it too. It's a different spin on kind of like a companion video game as well. Cause if people think of like a companion post-apocalyptic game, they think of like The Last of Us or something.
Yep.
But again, it's a different spin on that as well. And no, yeah, everything about the game was just so refreshing, even though it's a game that's, again, like coming up on 10 years old, and I still played it for the first time as if it's like a brand new game. It still feels refreshing and new.
Yeah, that's what happens when you, like, it's mostly 2D art, right? And it's just actual art. It's not art that had to be made because of technology on time. It's just art. So there's nothing to age.
No, there really isn't. That's how games age like a fine wine. And with the artwork in the game as well, it doesn't really adhere to a single color or hue. You know, like when you go back to a lot of Xbox 360 games, like, oh, it has that yellow, crudely called the piss filter, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of games. But this one is just so vibrant and dynamic. They struck a good balance between being engaging your senses, but not overloading them. It's like this perfect sweet spot that is just so engaging.
They do have a very specific use of cyan, yellow, and red, obviously. So there is real consistency. There is a real backbone to the style. Like I said, there's that obvious Art Nouveau influence. There's a little bit of the Art Deco. There's the techno-futurist side of it as well. So it's got really strong ideas of what it's doing, and then it explores them very, like, a very excited way. It's like it's going, it doesn't just have the one idea. It tries a lot of things with those elements.
Yeah, without compromising the sort of single vision that they were going for. And it's a testament to how good of a team that Supergiant is. And I can't believe I forgot to include this in the agenda, but I mean, I can't mention a Supergiant game without shouting out the music as well, which is just
really excellent. I figured we were going to go on a long tangent about that at some point.
Oh, yeah. I completely forgot about it. I don't know why. But no, yeah, it's fine. The music is okay. Again, it's another blend between kind of like the artwork and the environment design and the music of that period. But there's also some futuristic elements as well. And I think if you have a game where you play as a singer, like you should have some good music. And
yes,
the music in Bastion is great. The music in Hades is amazing. I still need to play Pyre, but I think I've heard some tracks from Pyre that are unsurprisingly awesome. And I think it's the legend Darren Korb again, who I think cooked for it. And I think
her name's Ashley Barrett.
Yeah, I think so. I think she's also a regular collaborator with them as well. And the ending, again, obviously without spoilers, the ending song.
Yep.
Amazing. It's awesome. It just
I finished my replay this morning and I have been singing it for the last like 2 or 3 hours.
I just sat there as it played. It plays like this little sort of moving collage, and I didn't even care that there weren't even credits. I was just sitting there soaking it in, like, God, man, that was great. But no, yeah, it's the music is, again, it's kind of a given with Supergiant games, along with the art, that's going to be amazing. But
it's going to bop.
We'll go into this more later, but there's an in-game side room that you can go into, and part of that is you can change the musical tracks, and you can unlock the various musical tracks within the game to play when you're doing this side content. But no, yeah, it's great. Again, I can't believe it took me this long to get to it with having played it many years ago. And so the other part that really anchors this game is the characters. And we mentioned Red is who you play as throughout the game. She has this big transistor sword. She is mute for all intents and purposes the entire game. And so you learn more about her through other characters and reading some other material as you progress through the game. And they basically talk about her, what her impact was. They dip into a little bit of kind of social media, what her popularity was among the people, how well regarded she was.
Yeah.
And it delves more into the relationship between her and the man whose spirit is in the sword grows throughout the game as well. So you do get a little bit of that kind of traditional companion bonding throughout the game.
I would even call it, it is a love story in a way.
Yeah. We can call it a love story. I didn't want to spoil too much, but
I felt like that part of their relationship is pretty well established from the start.
That's true. And I would say, even though that it is a love story, they even grow even more fond of each other by the game's end.
This isn't a meeting and fighting love story, but all the same.
No, all the same for sure. Their bond grows throughout the game. It really is a means of survival for both of them in a way, with how she has his spirit in the sword, and the sword is able to take on different abilities that you get throughout the game, which we'll talk to about with the gameplay. But there's also other citizens throughout the city, and they take the form of different abilities based on what their abilities were in the real world. And the more, again, interweaving gameplay and narrative, is the more you use their abilities, the more you learn about them as people. And then the final aspect of the characters are what's called the camarada. And I would almost describe them as sort of like a politburo, like a government, like an NGO almost. They're kind of like a government meets a company. I don't know how you would describe them. Maybe almost like a Shinra from Final Fantasy VII, but
they're like any organized political splinter group, right? It's just, you get a group of people, some of which, I mean, these were people who were in the upper parts of society. Yeah. They were known. They weren't insurrectionists or anything, but they had some big ambitions, and they found the people with the like-minded ideals and set about their plans in the background.
Yeah. I guess they really almost were like an aristocracy of sorts that kind of, unfortunately, saw their...
an upstart faction.
Yeah. A grand societal plan into action that led to ruin. But yeah, when we talk about the characters, what anything that stood out to you with kind of characters you come across, or without going into spoilers?
I think one thing that struck, that I was on this most recent replay, I kind of realized more about, was the character of Red, and just realizing her background as a singer, and how it wasn't just that she was a popular singer. There was actually there's a tinge of something a little more conflicting with society about it, to put it in a spoiler-free. I mean, you can probably guess, but you know, it actually gets into the themes of how music and singing can be a pretty derisive and controversial thing, which is particularly poignant considering the context of where she is and what makes her particularly different from a lot of the other people who've been sucked into the transistor.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at the end of the day, her singing is another medium of art, you know, and it comes down to individual expression. You know, in a society, these aristocrats, the camarada, are basically trying to engineer their own devices. So there's inherently going to be conflicts there when you, any type of true art is individualistic expression. So there's going to be conflicts.
I would even say that she conflicted with society before the camarada were around. So she's kind of in conflict with both sides of the thing.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, art, it's going to conflict with
this idealistic world.
Yeah. Any piece of artwork can conflict with, you know, any society, I think, at any stage. I don't know, maybe one day this podcast will have a spicy enough take to where society will be outraged, but hopefully it's for a good reason. But no, it's you learn more about the characters the more you play the game and the more that you use the skills. And I really appreciated that. There's a when you go into the sets of skills, which they call functions, the little glowing, you know, when there's more information, the little button for to find out more information glows, indicating that there's new information. And it was almost like a little dopamine hit, like, oh, I want to learn more.
Yeah, it was an interesting way of delivering more background for a story. And I particularly, reading entry logs is not everyone's cup of tea, but I kind of appreciate that they went this route, because it lets them keep the main thread and the main gameplay kind of tight and well-paced. And then it also keeps the overall mood of the game as that intimate, here's like the three or four characters who are actually important to the story at this given point in time, and we're focused on them. It feels like a short story.
It really does. That was exactly what I was going to say. It doesn't interrupt you or take you out by having to find this little audio log or note in the corner of the map and bringing it up, you know, putting it in your inventory and then going to your inventory, reading it. Like, the information that you're going to glean is already baked within the game mechanics and the systems that you're interacting with. So it's thematically, it's great as well. 'Cause it's basically the essences and the skills of people who died, and you're basically using the memories and the knowledge of fallen fellow citizens to learn more about the world and to fight back against the forces that are plaguing it.
You see this beautiful world and you use these useful tools and interesting elements. And then you might go, dang, I kind of want to know more about this, instead of it just being like fed at you. It's pretty out of the way for you to find it if you're interested in, but it gives you a reason to be interested.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's just, again, it's more interweaving between themes and gameplay and characters that was such a great idea that I didn't even think about until like probably halfway through the game. Like, oh man, I'm totally I'm appreciating it more and more, which I'm sure was their intent given how good they are. I can't think of really anything else to discuss about the characters without going into spoilers. The Camerata, I want to say there's like
four
of them. And as far as the characters, the side characters and the functions that you get, I think there's 15. I literally just played the game. I don't know.
Think math. About, well, there's 16 functions and four of them are Cameratas. One of them is another character. So it's about 11 side, like citizens, actually maybe 10, because I think actually one of the functions is Red's background.
Yeah. One of them. Yeah. I was going to say, if you play in the game for the first time, don't look up the functions, because you're gonna inevitably look into spoilers. And you're gonna spoil it for yourself. Each kind of function is its own moment, gameplay wise and character and thematic. So,
and it's a small game, so if you're trying to look up everything before you play, you're kind of missing the point.
No, yeah, I did not look at anything up before I played. In fact, I even commented to you when I finished the game. Like, I just about broke the game with the function setup that I had, so I was able to figure it out, and I think most people will be fine. And yeah, the game is short. It's, if you mainline it, it's like 6 hours. If you want to do like pretty comprehensive, you're going to do close to 10-ish. For me, I struggled with some of the side activities, but again, that was my option to do so.
Yeah, they're challenge modes, so it's always going to be kind of if you're really good at the game, this is going to take you 30 extra minutes. And if you're not particularly good at the game, you could be here for 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah. And it's entirely optional. I think I finished at level 12 when I beat the game, maybe 12 or 13. And again, I was like right at 10 hours. I unlocked achievements on Steam that were like 15%, which is like kind of wild considering kind of how old the game is and how diehard of a following it has. But no, I was very, very happy with my playthrough. And so, kind of speaking about the functions and the side content and the activities, the next thing
to the gameplay.
The gameplay, which was the biggest surprise for me, because again, that was the part that turned me off when I initially fired this game up, what seems like an eternity ago. And so I think what I'll do, I think you're better at this. You're the game designer. You can explain this combat better than I can. What would be kind of like your elevator pitch to people for the gameplay?
Well, it's a hybrid action RPG where instead of a traditional, it has a very well implemented pause and plan system. That's nothing particularly new. BioWare was doing it forever with games like Baldur's Gate and Neverwinter Nights, etc. But the way this one works is when you pause, you get a timeline of things, and each one of your moves, including your ability to move, lets you take a bit of that time and string them all together in a consolidated space. What I think is particularly fun about it is because of the time warping, things kind of work differently. Like different features of the moves become possible based on whether you're using them in real time or in turn-based. So it's not just like a Max Payne-esque, oh, I'm slowing things down to shoot better thing. It's like, okay, these moves are possible if I'm doing things in real time, and these things are possible if I do the plan, the turn-based. So that's really fun. Other than that, it kind of plays like a pretty approachable action RPG. You have a set of abilities that you can bind to the different buttons, and then you hit the button, it does the thing. Then a lot of the game is customizing which ones you have equipped and how they, each one's called a function. And what I really loved about this game is how they, you don't just get generic upgrades on your abilities. Like, oh, okay, so the hit move now gets a fire hit move. It's no, you take one ability and you set it as a modifier for another ability. So the abilities are the passives and they're the modifiers. Then you can mix and match them to get the kinds of exact effects you want, and you can come up with some pretty hilariously effective combinations. My favorite being Kull. I love Kull. Is the kill button. You break the game once you use it, right? But it's just so satisfying because boom, thing goes flying in the air and it's dead. And if you do the rest of your abilities right, I can do it 3 times in one turn-based thing. Everything's dead.
I used a void to break the game. In fact, I commented, but again, it's a testament to the how dynamic the combat is you can have so many insane builds to break the game. I was just melting people by the very, even the last boss. It was like a joke. I wiped him in like a minute. So, but yeah, you spoke to it beautifully. I think you reminded me just now, I think between, I was just playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth and now this game, I've been feasting on a real-time turn-based hybrid.
The hybrids, yeah.
Yeah, I've been feasting. Yeah, this game, I don't know that I've really quite played a game exactly like this combat or like identically close to me. Is there any that you can think of?
There's a few things in the indie space that have gotten close, but I have been like, this is one of the greatest tragedies of the gaming space is that Transistor came out and solved all the problems BioWare was trying to solve for years. And they just did it one time as this kind of experiment. And no one has tried to do anything with it again since. Or, well, not no one. I'm sure there's some indie game out there that's been doing a good job. But, like, no prominent game has really tried. Even Supergiant's next few games, they kind of abandoned the concept. Now, Hades has got really good action RPG combat.
Yes.
But I love this kind of hybrid scheme.
Hades was the first Supergiant game that I finished. I mean, so yeah, there is a lot of Hades in this game as well. You do get the Hades dash. Like, you do get that dash. And you even get one of the functions, if you combine them, you get that thing where you can leave, like, residual attacks along your path of your dash. So you see elements of that.
Oh, yeah. They definitely carried over the way things interact with your abilities and modifiers. That definitely carried over to Hades.
Yeah, it's so cool. And what I also appreciated about the game as well is that no matter how you equip your loadout with the different functions, it's very transparent about what the modifiers are going to be. Like, if you...
Yes.
If you have your primary functions, there's four of them, correct? Basically, your four face buttons.
Yeah.
And then you have some modifiers underneath, which you can unlock while progressing through the game and increasing your level. And then there's also set passives, any function you can equip in any of those roles as a primary, as a modifier, or as a passive.
Yes.
And it's very transparent about what's going to happen when you combine these two. And you can combine any of them in any way you want. It's awesome.
And there's a certain novel joy to just seeing your equipment list and just going, there are no slot locks. This is not like, it's like playing a game and realizing that you can put your pants in the head slot. And then suddenly you're wearing pants on their head, which now that I say that is like, oh my gosh, why is that not a thing in more games?
Yeah. Who knew? Who knew that transmog was only like a halfway there thing, but,
unlocked clothing slots. Let me put my underwear on my hands.
Make your helmet your underwear or something. Yeah, it would be. That is almost like what it's like. It is almost like an all you can eat buffet. You're like, one time when I was on a cruise, I got ice cream at 2 a.m. It's like, you know, in Transistor, you can get your ice cream at 2 a.m. if you want. That's how you want to roll, and that's absolutely fine. And yeah, you can have genuine builds in this game. I did not anticipate that. You can do some crazy, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
There's abilities to change allegiances for your targets. There's abilities to create a clone of yourself. It gets absolutely wild with what you can do.
That said, it is still a small game with a...
Yeah.
It's a wonderful, joyful sandbox that just makes you go, darn, I wish the sandbox was so much bigger.
Yeah, well, it goes back to why hasn't a bigger developer like ripped this off or done something on a grander scope with it? But yeah, there's limits to the combat, which I'll go into in a little bit.
Especially developmentally, because you have to go and account for a bunch of combinations. So I know why a lot of people don't like to do it, but man, it's so worth it.
Yeah, it really is. And another aspect, well, there's two other, was there any other thing you just wanted to comment on about like the immediate sort of moment-to-moment combat?
I will say that it's kind of both its biggest strength and its biggest weakness, although I guess I could save some of that for when we get to caveats.
Yeah, for sure. There's two other things that I wanted to point out about the combat. One of them is when you level up, you get these sort of limiters, which it's very, when you play, you've played Hades, correct? You've like played a lot.
Hades, Bastion. The only one I haven't played so far is Pyre, which is like, I have it sitting there. I still haven't gone to it. I feel like such a fool for not doing it yet because it sounds like it's really good.
Pyre will be a future game on this podcast eventually. But so these limiters in Transistor, if for anyone who's played Hades, they work as the modifiers when you raise the heat level in Hades. So it's like, hey, you get this buff, but there's also this debuff on you. And so in this case, in Transistor, you get EXP buffs. You'll get like 2%, 4%, 6%. But on the other hand, you will get limiters. So an example of an aspect of this combat is when you die, so to speak, you don't immediately die and lose your life. You lose a function.
It's the most expensive function you have equipped on a main slot.
Okay. Okay.
Ask me how I know.
Ask you how you know. I think a couple of the limiters actually manipulate what function you lose when you die. Yeah. Anyway, the limiters, that is an aspect of the combat. You don't have to use any of them. You can turn them all off, kind of similar with the Hades heat level. If you just want to go through and play the game with your traditional function loadout and buffs and everything, you can do that. Another aspect of the gameplay that I didn't anticipate, but I really, really enjoyed, and I unlocked Steam achievements for this, is there is a side room called the backdoor. Again, it's very thematic, right? Like it's a backdoor. It's like a secret room.
It's backdoor in the system.
Yeah, backdoor in the system, exactly. And it's kind of like a little, kind of, I call it like a safe haven. Not really a hub area because it serves limited purposes. But
yeah, it doesn't get you anywhere. It's just a break room, essentially.
Yeah, it really is like a break room. That's where you can go and you can listen to the music. It's basically like a little VR room. There's a beach coastline. There's a little beach chair and an umbrella. And there's a dog and a beach ball. You can kind of get a little bit of moment of respite. There's also side challenge rooms there. It'll challenge your speed, your survivability. And I think there's one other type of challenge as well, but that's where if you want extra challenge and you want to like increase your leveling and get some more limiters, you can go and do that there. And that was very rewarding. I did a lot of those. Was that anything about the kind of the limiters and the backdoor that you wanted to talk about?
I will say that I usually don't do a whole lot of the side stuff in the game, oddly enough. But what I always make sure to do is go sit in the hammock, because then you'll get a nice little extra bit of the dialogue.
Yeah, you do get a little bit of extra banter with the spirit in your sword.
Yes, and the dog's pretty funny.
The sunset is beautiful. It did remind me a little somewhat of when you finish a run in Hades. It's kind of like, it's, you know, like a little bit of a breath of fresh air.
Still don't know what that feels like because I have yet to finish a single run of Hades. I don't know why I'm so bad at that game, but I cannot beat Hades. Like the actual last boss, I always die there.
Well, that game is like Returnal to me, where it's like you just need to find a single weapon that clicks with you. And with Hades, you can pick what weapon you want. You don't have to, that part is at least not RNG. You don't have to worry about like getting that gun as a drop or that weapon as a drop. So did you unlock the gun in Hades yet?
Oh yeah. I've put like 20, 30 hours into Hades. I've unlocked a bunch of stuff. I just am so risky of a player. This is why.
Oh, are you like a glass cannon or what?
Oh, every time. And I can't avoid it. I can't avoid it. I have tried. I cannot stop picking glass cannon tactics.
Men are stubborn creatures.
Yeah. And then when I have these things, I still end up like, even if I picked nice tanky build, I will still play it as close to the limit as I can until I eventually crash. This is why I've only gotten like one finished run in Dead Cells, no matter how much I play that game and love it. This is why I can't even get anywhere in Returnal. I can't. I can't play Returnal. I suck.
If I remember, you're a dex build, Chad, in like some FromSoft games too, so you're a glass cannon in those. You, at least you're consistent, your brand consistency.
Although I have gone from being a dex build, Chad, in FromSoft games to being no armor and strength, and all strength. So just no clothes, big sword. Either it dies in one hit or I die in one hit. There's no in between.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're consistent in living dangerously, so.
Yeah, I love the edge.
Yeah. You have to live on the edge.
Man lives by the sword. Man dies by the sword. The big sword.
Yeah, the big sword. I think we covered the gameplay pretty well.
Yep.
Yeah, it was surprisingly rewarding. Like I said, I've been feasting on hybrid real-time turn-based games. I would think, I don't know if this is a caveat, maybe the only thing, not really a caveat, I probably could have used with maybe one or two more boss battles. It's a limit of the budget, I'm sure, and the resources. But
yeah, that is one of the more unfortunate parts. And what I was kind of saying is kind of the weakness of the game is the setup for it is so good, but the default challenges are just kind of like, they're close, but you're left a little unsatisfied as far as what they present you with like the enemy design and things. It's like, there's these moments where it's like, oh, okay, I'm seeing it. Or like, oh, this was an interesting challenge, but it's just like, it's so quick and ephemeral. And it's just like, ah, oh, that's the one thing I wish about this game that wasn't as ephemeral feeling.
Yeah. There's a sequence in the game where this thing stalks you is what I'll say. And even that, when that resolved, I'm like, oh, okay. But yeah, we can, that's a good segue into the caveats, and I have it here as number two, but we can go ahead and address it right now. Is that the first caveat we'll discuss is I think the enemy variety did feel rather limited. It did kind of border on repetitive for me, but I will say that it's right about when I got tired of fighting the enemies, it introduced new ones, like a new challenge.
Yeah. It knows that it doesn't have a wealth of stuff to offer you, but you are also pretty well aware that there is not a wealth of combat scenarios offered to you. Like, you're aware of it, even though they are managing it well.
Yeah, they do a good job. Like, they have the standard enemies. They have enemies that, like, send other adds at you. They have enemies that shield and protect other enemies. So it's a decent variety of enemy types. The final boss, I did feel pretty underwhelming, maybe because my build was broken.
Oh yeah, mine was too. Although I did notice that if you don't have a broken build on the last guy, you actually can die fairly quickly.
Yeah, he will melt you, and you need to be really quick on the turn button. Yeah, or he will get you. I think he did deplete one health bar from me, but yeah, other than that, I melted him.
It's one of those combat systems where if you get it, you get it, and you probably won't be too challenged, but if you don't get it, it's probably pretty darn difficult.
No, yeah, I really opted for initiating a turn as much as I really could. Having the dash helps, obviously. Having the dash for the more real-time combat and invasions and stuff helped out a lot. But yeah, I really think the game was mostly meant to be engaged with at the turn-based level.
On my replays, I've actually found good ways of working more real time into it. Like I said, there's certain things that you can only do real time due to the way cooldowns work. I didn't mention earlier, but when you take a turn, you go on cooldown from all abilities. Well, with a few exceptions, but your main abilities all go on cooldown as well until your turn is available again. So you got like 5 seconds of downtime that you have to run around and try not to die, because you're completely vulnerable now. So there's a lot of trade-offs that are being made, but with certain ability combinations, you can kind of have backup plans for when you're running around off turn, or you can even make real time a little more of your main thing, and then turn just becomes like your execution section. So it's there. It's just, if it got like another game's worth of polish, oh, it could have been fantastic.
This makes me almost kind of wish they've done a Transistor 2.
Yeah, I know.
I'm amped for Hades 2, but
I actually am. I'm surprisingly not that amped for Hades 2, because I'm that one person just like, I liked Hades, but please, Transistor was the best one.
Yeah, I totally get it. And I understand why it's many people's favorite of their four games so far.
Yep.
The second thing, well, we already brought up the backdoor. It's not really, I wouldn't even call it a caveat. I would consider it like a perk of the game. But yeah, the backdoor as a caveat, I would make sure to do some of that stuff, or at least give it a shot, because I think there's really no punishment for losing. You quickly get sent back to the backdoor area. So it has a series of doors for the different types of challenges. And there's like one door will have like a series of six challenges, and the other will have seven. But And if you fail, you just get sent back to the back door. It's like that, still that immediate area. So
yeah, it's accessible challenges. They're not like these really obscure, hard to access things or anything like that.
Oh, no. Yeah. I would say the final one or two of each of them where it was like, I was really having to stop sweating and figure out my build. And some of them, they're very strict scenario based. So they will give you the loadout that you have to work with, but some others you can customize your loadout. Yeah. It's a good test of your abilities and how to engage the various combat systems. So yeah, definitely engage with that.
One caveat to the backdoor challenges is, and I've never done all of them, so maybe there's some unlock at the end that I never gotten, was unaware of, but that just kind of brings more to the caveat, is it doesn't feel like there's too much extrinsic rewards to doing them. Like, you're not going to get special gameplay features, and you very rarely will get interesting story dialogue out of doing the challenges. So if you're going to do them, it's just because you enjoy the gameplay enough on its own to be doing it.
You'll get some EXP, which when you level up, it unlocks more like modifier slots, and it unlocks more basically the amount of slots that you have for how much space a function takes up. So it's like your function capacity. So it's basically a way to increase your level and become more powerful of sorts. There's no hidden functions behind it. There's no actual hidden ability. It's just a way to kind of increase your capacity to equip more functions at once. So,
and that at that point, to me, not just this game, but a lot of games that have challenge modes like that, it's like eating pasta without the sauce. It's like, it might be really good pasta. It might be really well cooked. And boy, I just love the pasta itself, but I want to eat it with the sauce, you know? I want the whole package.
Yeah. There really isn't necessarily much. You're not going to miss out on much story or world building necessarily, but just consider it when you see it. It's very optional, and it is there. So I definitely wanted to point that out. I would say that the only other true caveat that I have, and I'm not sure whether you'll agree with me or not, is that, again, I played Hades first before this, and the voice acting in that game is so good. And this one definitely felt like their first actual attempt at doing voice acting in their game. And I understand, given the nature of the story and the characters, there's definitely like a somber nature to it all. But to me, a lot of the voice acting did feel like either very inexperienced or even maybe just staff members of Supergiant who were just literally reading.
I will say that I actually like it probably a bit more than you, but I also fully agree with what you're saying, is that I think one character in particular, the Camerata, he seems like the one who's kind of the roughest. In some ways, I feel like they got themselves a little bit of an out by it, with it, you know, it, you're dealing with like engineers and artists and technical people in the story. So it kind of makes sense that no one you're talking to is really all that eloquent. Yeah. And kind of avoiding spoilers, but one of the most, like, in writing or like as described, one of the most persuasive and eloquent people who's in the cast ends up never speaking at all. So two of them, actually. So they're... It is a little funny element to it. I actually really liked the guy who does most of the speaking at the end. The last guy. I loved his voice. It was like, I mean, not because it like sounds amazing, but it was just like, shoot, who's the guy from Jurassic Park and Human Fly and all that?
Jeff Goldblum.
It was almost like a Jeff Goldblum-esque experience. Obviously not to that level, but like, it was pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I will say for the voice acting, even though it wasn't necessarily performed the most convincingly, there was like a somberness to a lot of it. It made this journey throughout this game even more of a tragedy. Like you could hear the, I don't know if depression is the right word, but you can hear like the melancholy in everyone's voice.
Melancholy is a good word for it.
They genuinely felt bad about what happened. They're like, God, they go right up to the line of just saying, we're so sorry. We're terribly sorry. We didn't mean for any of this to happen, without them really saying it. And there is like a tinge of lament when you get to the end of the game. The ending of the game, I would say, is pretty bittersweet. The ending of the game did genuinely surprise me. Almost.
I love it.
Almost shocked me is what I'll say.
I love it so much.
It's so good. I don't want to say any more because I would threaten to spoil it. But
there's like four voice actors total in the whole project, and only two of them really do a lot of talking. So yeah, it's not a big voice acted thing. But what, just like Bastion, there's the one character is narrating to you basically the whole way through.
The coolest cool guy voice ever, without a doubt.
And only in this time, instead of him being like a narrator of the story, he is a participant with you this time. So it's a kind of fun mix up to that dynamic. It keeps their signature style, but recontextualizes it to something a little more fresh.
Yeah. And even the narrator, he did a pretty good job of kind of mixing between the noir aspects, you know, like you get the voiceover narration in a noir movie, but he was also came across as like a human being. You could hear like the kind of the struggle and pain and torment in his voice.
Yeah.
And how much he cared. But it's kind of like the enemies thing where it's like you kind of tell what the limitations were for when they were mm-hmm. making the game. But yeah, I just wanted to point that out. If anyone who was expecting like a super cool guy voice from Bastion or like really, really awesome voiceover work from Hades, you're not going to necessarily get that. So it's kind of temper your expectations, but it fits within the world. So
yeah. And it certainly avoids the thing that I complain about with a lot of, say, localization voice work in particular, is it does fit the mood. Like it services the mood of the story first and is not trying to be people giving these, I don't even want to pin it on like a lot of the typical local or like voice actors in the space, you know, trying to like overplay their role or anything, but just like, for some reason, there's some problem that's kind of endemic in a lot of games where the voice acting will just be way too much for what's going. So subtlety is just kind of hard in a lot of games, particularly localized ones.
Yeah. I think in this case, the direction for what they were going for was on point, but yeah, you could tell like, we're certainly not getting like a Troy Baker here. So something like that. So.
I like somber and I like having this sort of thing.
Yeah, it definitely captures the mood and the vibe, without a doubt. So yeah, it was directed well, decent enough for what they were going for. But I can't really think of anything else. Was there anything else about the game that you wanted to shout out? Or
I just want to say that this game was like one of the first ones that came out in my lifetime that I would call about the equivalent of seeing a great painting. Like, it's not exactly going to consume your life or anything, but you're gonna look at it and you're gonna think about it for a long time after. It's like this fleeting experience that you enjoy it and then it just sits in your head. That's what it was for me.
I totally get that, and like I said, I understand now why so many, including yourself obviously, think so highly of this game. It's one that I may I'm notorious, but I'm well known for really hardly ever replaying, given how little of a time demand it is and how comprehensive my first playthrough was. I think you said you were able to breeze through this game in like 3 to 4 hours. The average mainline-ish playthrough is 6 hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not going to take up much of your time really at all, but it's going to be memorable. So that tells you how good the game is.
And there's something with the new game plus. I don't know if there's some deep secret I've missed in this game over the years, because I've purposely tried, when I really like something, I purposely don't try to plumb its depths. I don't, you know, I like letting it be what I've experienced and not trying to just dig up every little detail. But yeah, there's some interesting small details on the replays that kind of help it be a little more interesting.
There is a new game plus. I think they call it like recursion.
Yep. Again, another programming.
Yeah, and it tells you like, hey, you get all of your entire loadout when you start the game, but also they tell you that the world responds in kind, so it's going to be more challenging. But it's standard like in a new game plus thing, which is cool for like an indie game to do that. But now, was there anything else that you wanted to shout out?
No, I think that we covered it. I guess I'll just say I had this game's art as my desktop backgrounds for like a year or two, if not longer. So yeah, beautiful game. You should all play it. Just go look at it. Go hear it.
Yeah, go hear it. Let the artwork and the music and everything just really kind of whisk you away. I kept wanting to. That's another sign of a good game, is you're thinking about it when you're not playing it, you know. And I've been so lucky recently between that game and Rebirth and Dragon's Dogma 2. I think all those other two you've been engrossed in as well. Maybe Rebirth is still kind of a state secret with one of your podcast mates, but
no.
your thoughts on it.
I've just got it shelved, though. So
you just got it shelved. Okay.
My full opinions probably won't even happen for another year, because I'm just like, oh, I got to move on, do some other stuff.
Oh, yeah. The games will always be there. But no, yeah, I think we covered it pretty well. Please play this game. It's coming up on its 10th anniversary. Again, it's on pretty much all the platforms except Xbox. I mean, I hope that...
Who needs stinky Xbox?
Because Hades was on Game Pass, so I think there's some kind of relationship there. They've been able to shake hands and... you know, pat, rub each other's backs, but maybe they can get the other games. That would be great.
Transistor was actually involved with, like, back when the PS4 was coming out and Sony was trying to do the indie initiative. This was one of the big gets they had. So I think there's some licensing stuff there that I doubt Sony is going to just give up, especially since Supergiant has since become a big name. I mean, if they're smart, Sony's not going to let it over.
No, yeah, and I recall Sony was pretty... some pretty strict thick walls when it came to indie developers about rights and licensing and where else they could publish the game. But
especially if you were one of the ones gaining a lot of funding.
Yeah. There was a lot of money thrown around to indie devs then, but no, yeah, it's on all the major platforms. I mean, it's dirt cheap. I don't even know what the standard retail price is. It's always, their games are always on sale too. So like very often you can buy them. You'll buy like all four of their games for $20 or something.
Whatever it is, you're paying too little.
Yeah. You're paying too little. I would have paid $30 for this game, at least, maybe 40, given how replayable it is with the builds. But no, thank you. Thank you for Connor for coming on. This was a game that I had been wanting to play, an episode I'd been wanting to do for a while. And as is the case with many backlog games, maybe you're the same way. I'm just like, on a whim, I just look at my Steam library. I'm like, it's time to play that. So,
and I've been trying to get everyone to play this game for a long time, and yet no one listens. And then they finally play it. I don't know if I can even count on one hand. I think you're like the only person I can think of right now who has actually played it.
Well, see, that's the key. You need to find people who do podcasts and convince them.
Yeah. So now this is here, and now hopefully you'll convince a bunch of other people to play it. You all need to go play this game.
So if you happen to know, I don't know, two other people who do a podcast, like maybe they do a podcast with you, maybe they'll play the game too.
Oh, maybe. That'd be neat. I hear one of them likes short games, so it might be good for him.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, there's some turn-based stuff for Straw Hat, and there's no real jumping in this game. I don't know if Parrot would be up his alley.
Hey, when you hit RB and you do the little flourish, he jumps.
There you go. I mean, that is the most artistic flourish jump that you can get, honestly.
Yeah, and when you do call, the enemy jumps really high if you do it right.
You eat them up in the air. You super jump. Yeah, they almost go off the screen. I'm like, what the hell?
They do go off the screen when I do it.
You eat them up in the air. It's funny. But no, thank you again, everyone. Please play this game. I was gonna say we're super fans of Supergiant, but we're massive fans of Supergiant here. I'm gonna be there day one for Hades 2 early access or whatever you want to call it. I will play Pyre eventually. I've heard that's more of a sports game than anything, which I'm very intrigued by.
It's interesting. In fact, I barely even knew what it was until I saw a Never Knows Best video on YouTube about it. And it's like, oh, that is not at all what I was thinking this was going to be. Okay, I definitely need to play it now.
Oh, yeah. It's like the transition from Bastion to Transistor. I mean, yeah, they're both isometric games, but it's like, wow, this is definitely different. But again, it's a testament to Supergiant. They're amazing. One of the best developers in the industry. It's so great to see them really have a glow up, but like a growth and exposure due to Hades. And
yeah,
we'll be there. I'll be there day one for Hades.
Just hopefully they don't grow too much, so you know, get the same problems a lot of studios get. Gotta keep that core value. Don't sell out to the man.
Yeah, you gotta keep your core ethos. You don't want to try to over-engineer anything, otherwise you'll end up like Cloud Bank in the Camerata.
But no, they seem to be doing good. So
yeah, for sure. Well, thank you again. I'm glad we were able to finally do this episode. Of course, I had Parrot on for The Force of Nature. That was Chibi Robo. I have you on, and I've been in discussions with Straw Hat.
His solo debut on the podcast.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know. We'll see. There is a there's a game series that rhymes with snails that I've been considering going back and giving another shot to. But I know if I do that episode, it will be there will be many a takes.
What does it say to me now that it took me like 15 seconds to realize what you were referring to?
I couldn't think of another word that had the R at the beginning that wasn't just like name of the series. Because if I utter the name of that series, like
it's over.
Well, five fans will show up in this Riverside call out of nowhere. So they will. They're like ground moles or groundhogs that just out of nowhere. But no, we're in discussions for an episode to do with him. And thank you again. Hope you enjoy the rest of your day and weekend. And
it was good. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh yeah, anytime. Definitely, we'll do it again sometime in the future. But yeah, thank you again. And we